Tuesday, November the 14th, the day of our last state visitor scheduled for this year. It's also the very last of Indian summer. The golden leaves of the ginkgo trees had fallen like a dropped cloak around the trunks, and I took my last look at the garden as I hurried over to Lyndon's office a little before 11 to join him for the arrival ceremonies. Grounds were very sparsely full. I'd spent a bit of the morning with Marilyn, making sure that our house guests, tea guests, and others were invited to come to the arrival ceremonies. I wore my green ensemble by Marquise and reminded Lyndon as we stepped out of the office that we were going to be on educational TV. I met Mr. Sato with a certain feeling of sympathy, because I'd seen pictures of his departure from Tokyo, where over 4,000 students had protested his coming to the United States in what ended with a knockdown, drag-out fight with the police. I must say he looked like a man who could handle a situation. Tall for a Japanese, and young for his years, which were more than ours. Mrs. Sato, in carefully enunciated English, quite slow, told me how glad she was to come to our country. Her English was labored, but it was quite a compliment to us, which I can never match in any language, much less Japanese. The speeches were brief. The trumpets blew their last note from the balcony, our visiting chief of state this year, and well before 12, I was upstairs in the Lincoln sitting room to have coffee with four couples, Rabbi and Mrs. Levi Olin, a member of the Board of Regents of the university, and the Leon Stones and the Youngbloods from Austin and Waco, and Dr. and Mrs. Kosmetsky, who's head of the School of Business Administration at the university, and one of the shining lights, they tell me. By mistake in the usher's office, two couples of our house guests, the Will Odoms and the Sam Winters, had been asked to join us, and so we were 13 in the little Lincoln sitting room. But George brought extra chairs in, and coffee and little ham biscuits, and we talked of the university, and Austin and Linda. And then I started them on their tour in the Lincoln room, telling them how it was all afloat with pink tulle and chattering bridesmaids at the time of Lucy's wedding. The university certainly has two lively characters in Rabbi Olin and Dr. Kosmetsky. Later, Frank Irwin told me that Dr. Kosmetsky taught business administration at some eastern school in his youth, and then had gotten out to see how he would fare in the business world. Made lots of millions, and returned to his first love, teaching. Here, the university had met and mastered the competition, and I've learned that there's no keener than competition among universities for top-notch professors. The university paid him something like $35,000 a year, and he had, in his 2 years there, made gifts of close to $200,000. I worked with Bess in my room on the seating for the dinner, and on mail had lunch on a tray, talked with Jamie Symington about topics of conversation with the Japanese. And then, in bed to rest, hopefully doing two things at once, I read my briefing on Japan and the biographical data on the Satos. I had a short nap, and then up and dressed for the birthday party for Carol Lace. It was at 4:30 in the yellow room with a very small group, all Lyndon's idea. He was quick to plan things like this, thoughtful, dear, spur-of-the-moment things, and then quite capable of giving them to me to handle. I went in his bedroom at 4:30. He was inundated with papers and on the phone. He said, "You all just go on. I'll come as soon as I can." And it was 5:30, but he couldn't have come to a more understanding group. Carol, who at once gives you the impression of being both very capable and very feminine, and her most remarkable husband, Ellsworth Bunker, everybody's hero in the State Department, the first to arrive. And then I was so glad that she had her brother and sister-in-law there, and Peggy Brown, with whom she had served in some eastern post, and who was from Austin and had been my hostess in Korea just a year ago. There were the Harrimans and the Walt Rostow. The men were soon deep in conversation with Henry Brandon in a corner, but not before I'd had time to tell him I'd liked our story and that he had a world full of readers, dozens of whom had written me. The Humphreys were there, and Bob and Margie McNamara, he in and out in less than 10 minutes. Some friends of Carol's from the department, the Harry Barnes and the Douglas Hex, and the Reverend and Mrs. Hamilton. I must admit, when I saw the Reverend on the list, I flinched. The Doug Caters from our staff, and Mrs. Bob Comer looking for her husband tomorrow, like glow in anticipation. It was Mr. Barnes, I believe, who had been in Cyprus when we were. It had become his job to go out and get the stone from St. Barnabas's tomb and deliver it to me. He had a very funny story to tell about it. They'd traveled to the old monastery and duly picked out a stone, crumbling away at the bottom of the wall, taken it to a stone cutter and told him what to and scribe. They'd come back, and there he had a fine, fresh, shiny stone, precisely inscribed. "But this can't be that old stone." "Oh, no," said the stonecutter. "I didn't think you'd want to give Mrs. Johnson that old stone. I got you a nice new one." "Where did you put the old one?" "I just flung it down the hillside." So together they clambered down the hill until, the desk man swears, he found the very stone, got it inscribed, and now it rests in little St. Barnabas in Fredericksburg. I sat on the sofa and had a good talk with Carol. Her grounding in that part of the world goes back many years. She'd served in India when Ellsworth Bunker was ambassador there, and had, of course, been assigned in Nepal also. The complete severance of that mountain country from the world around is hard for me to comprehend. Absolutely shut off until just a couple of decades ago. In a few moments of quiet talk with Ellsworth Bunker, "Yes, Vietnam is going to come out all right. It will take time. Korea did. The Dominican Republic did." His attitude seemed a combination of quiet confidence and optimism, salted with realism. He wanted to come home, he said, to see how deep was the national mood against the war. President Lyndon came in, and a delightful wedding cake which had on it an elephant. No reference to the Democratic Party, we assured Carol, but a Nepal elephant, and tennis rackets, and other insignia of her life in Nepal. Lyndon made a very graceful toast. Champagne went around, and we all raised our glasses to the birthday of an extraordinary woman in public service. By 6:30, the guests were gone. Mr. Pear came in for a comb-out, and I went through that foolish feminine rigmarole about what to wear. Molly Parnas was coming. I'd love to wear one of her dresses. And with Mr. Sato, the guest of honor, I just must wear my pearls that he'd given me on the last trip. And remember, Education TV was doing the show on it, so it must photograph well. It couldn't be anything I'd worn lately. No. I finally wore my Adele Simpson gold chiffon and hoped for the best. Telephoned my house guests to welcome them, and a little past 8 was down on the North Portico with Lyndon to greet the Satos and their party. Mrs. Sato wore a pale orchid kimono sashed with a gold obi. When we came upstairs with Mr. Mickey, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Shimodas, he's the ambassador, another Japanese official, and the Humphreys, Katzenbachs, and our Ambassador Johnson. I have not seen the wife of a chief of state try harder, and that in itself was pleasant. She spoke English, though it was obviously difficult. We sat on the yellow sofa. Linda came in, and I introduced her around. And there was the exchange of gifts, always hard to pry my husband and the honor guest loose from conversation. Ours, besides the familiar Tiffany desk set and the two gold clocks, included an album of photographs of the Washington cherry trees around the tidal basin and Haynes Point. A gesture of thanks for all the new ones the Japanese are giving us. And theirs, how delightful, included a Sony video recorder. I can just see me getting all my favorite TV programs down at the ranch, laid by for quiet hours, and a lacquer cabinet for jewelry or small items. And then, with Chuck leading the way, and this, I suppose, will be his last state dinner at the White House, taking the colors down the staircase, we descended to the state floor with pictures at the foot of the steps, and then into the East Room for one of the largest parties of the year, from the cabinet, the Fowlers, and the McNamara. There's been quite an exchange of monetary and trade ministers between Japan and us in the last several years, and Trudy has been in on these visits. The Senate was sparsely represented with the John McClellans and the Danny Inouyes. There was Governor Kerner of Illinois, and the House quite abundantly represented 8 congressmen, including the Bill Bates, she's one of my 81st friends from Massachusetts, and the Jim Wrights, and of course Spark Matsunaga and Patsy Mink. Dorothy McArdle said the guest list reflected the vigor and imagination of American sport and entertainment world. Baseball and movies being very big in Japan, they were certainly represented. There were the Robert Gibsons, he's a Negro baseball star with the Cardinals. Tall, well-built, very pleasant, and nice-looking. And General William Eckert, who's New York City's commissioner of baseball. And from the movies, the Kirk Douglases, whom I hardly recognize because he's got black hair and a mustache. All from a movie called The Mafia. And Ida Lupino, now in TV. Our old friend Dick Adler. And of course, Tony Bennett, singer and hoofer, who would entertain us later. From government, there was the Rosal Hydes of the FCC, and Roger Stevens with Christine, and handsome Maxwell Taylor, special consultant to the president, one of those men whom presidents never quite let retire. From one of my trips, Charles Adams, who had the luncheon for me, at the home of Presidents John and John Quincy Adams, extremely dignified and impressive, and I was pleased that he had flown back from England especially for this visit. And also, the Hugh Brooks, whom I had met on my trip to Williams College, and found very interesting and unexpectedly friendly. There were old friends, Jim Rose and the Earl Clements, she looking sadly feeble, the Dale Millers and the Theodore McKeldins, and Frank Stanton and Ruth, and the Cliff Carters, and Dr. Robert Beamer, with whom I work on archives, and Henry Diamond, with whom I work on beautification. Business was well represented, with the Leo Harveys of Aluminum, the president of the National Association of Manufacturers, Mr. Gullender, our old friends George Killians of the American President Lines, and Roger Blau of U.S. Steel. And for my stay up, of course, Okamoto, and his presence gave me keen pleasure. The tallest man at the party, and certainly one of the most sought after by the newspaper women, was Jay Rockefeller, the lovely Sharon, who had spent years in Japan, and was my first name to go on the list. Linda, who was not invited to the dinner, spent time with them before and after. And the Washington government was well represented, with Walter Washington, beaming but weary, and Mrs. John Hackinger alone. John had to go to a D.C. council meeting, and thank heavens he considered it more necessary than a White House party. At the last moment, as always, two or three couples had dropped out, illness, bad flying conditions. Inviting someone close to me to fill these places, someone who works harder than they need to work, because they like to work, is one of my favorite pleasures here. And so I was delighted to be able to have Sandy Fox and his wife, and also Dorothy Dorito. And because I wanted them to visit with her mother and father, Bill Crooks of Vista. She's the daughter of the Butts, our house guest. At last, the line of 190 was finished, and I took the Prime Minister into the Blue Room. I had Mr. Mickey on my left, Mr. Adams of B. Adams family, and Walter Washington, and Jim Wright were at my table. I'd spent time on this seating, selecting a gay place for Molly Parnes, putting Irwin Miller between Elspeth and Libby Rowe, two of the brightest women I know, and close to Frank Stanton, and a congressman next to Bonetta, to whom hopefully she could talk Job Corps to good effect, and my friend Mr. Hugh Book, by Trudy Fowler. It was pleasant, but not wildly exciting. Lydia Katzenbach doing more than her share to lend gaiety and sparkle. For dessert, we had strawberry Yamaguchi in honor of our guests. The Prime Minister autographed his menu in Japanese for me. And the toasts, I thought, were memorable. Lyndon addressed himself to the crises that both he and Sato face in East Asia and around the world, and borrowed from Abraham Lincoln, which he's done quite a lot this year, and for good reason. I'm here. I must do the best I can and bear the responsibility of taking the course which I feel I ought to take. Let us not be frightened from our duty by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. Let us have faith that right makes might. The Prime Minister's was brief and businesslike, and then we had coffee in the Red Room, and I introduced as many of the newspaper ladies as we came close to. We took our seats in the front row of the East Room and listened to Tony Bennett and his group of five, including a harpist who plays jazz.